Well, I'm tempted to say tonight, on your mark. We've been looking together at the Gospel of Mark and using our time together as a kind of walking through some sound principles of study of the Bible, and hopefully there's some transference that's taking place, some seepage as we share together of principles that I'm using in the study of Mark that are becoming effective in your own life. And we want to take a moment, as we always do when we sit down with a passage of Scripture, just to think for a moment of where we're at. And one of the critical things, of course, in Bible study is to always set a context. If we don't set a context, then we might dive in and not get good doctrine, not get good teaching, because we're sort of picking up a verse that's maybe not has, we don't think has any reference to something that's come before it or behind it, and we can, you know, do like the old phrase goes, Judas went out and hanged himself, and go thou and do likewise, and what thou doest do quickly. Putting three texts together and jumping to a conclusion that would be a bad jump, you know. So I always want to take a moment to contextualize, if you will. And we have looked now at Mark 1:1 through Mark 4:34. In the course of doing that, we've come up with some major subdivisions, and actually we're paragraph titling every paragraph. And then we put paragraphs together in a unit of thought and try to create a title for them. Rather than walk through all the paragraphs we've covered, let's just walk through the units. There are five units that we've already looked at. The first being, what? 1:1 through 1:13, four paragraphs that dealt with the theme of preparation. Well, come on now, put on your... Got to come along here. Okay, preparation, first four paragraphs. The next seven paragraphs, 1:14 through 45, is opening events. Jesus has begun his ministry by three actions: preaching, healing, and calling disciples. And then the third section, 2:1 through 3:6, is opposition, where for the first time he generates opposition, which arises first of all over his forgiveness of sins and then continues over his breaking of tradition and breaking Sabbath laws. So much so that when that section is done, there is a plot to kill him. The fourth section, 3:7 through 35, through the end of chapter 3, deals with counter-opposition. Now Jesus is going on the attack. He is calling disciples to himself. He is charging the Pharisees with the prospect of having committed eternal sin. And he's also forcing his family to redefine their relationship to him. And the fifth part that we covered it last week, 4:1 through 34, deals with a series of parables that are about the theme of the kingdom. Kingdom parables. Okay. So now we come tonight to the sixth part, major part of the Gospel of Mark, beginning with 4:35. Notice how we say that this new section begins with 4:35. When we think sometimes in reading by chapters that, well, there's a division of thought with a chapter unit, but unfortunately sometimes the chapter units are mislabeled because they were not labeled until the 17th century. When did we get chapter titles and verses? Well, with the invention of the printing press. That's where we got it. Suddenly you had the Bible that was being mass-produced, and people needed to know where to find things. And so there was an insertion of chapter titles and verse titles. Sometimes they can be helpful, sometimes they may be confusing. 4:35, we just want to take a moment to read each of these paragraphs and to assign a quick title to it, and then we'll come back, do an overview of the section, and then we'll look individually again at what truth is coming across to us. On that day, that is the day when he was teaching the parables of the kingdom, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." Leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And a great storm of wind arose, and the waves beat into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. And he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care if we perish?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind, and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. He said to them, "Why are you afraid? Have you no faith?" And they were filled with awe, and said to one another, "Who then is this, that even wind and sea obey him?" Now I know if you're reading the New Translation, the NIV, that you have several different paragraphs there. The NIV here is all messed up and incorrect. There is only one paragraph here. It has one unit of thought, and they're just trying to break it down into newspaper-style English, where the common person for today finds it difficult to read a paragraph that's more than two sentences long. So, you know, there's really only one paragraph here, folks, and it deals with the theme of what? How would you title this? What's the key word that rises out of this passage? It is a what? Storm. So it's just, I suppose, storm or sea storm. It's the Galilee Sea, not an ocean, but called the Galilee Sea. So sea storm will be sufficient here. Now we get to this really incredible paragraph that goes from verse 1 through verse 13 in Mark. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes, also the Gadarenes and also the Gergesenes. There are three parallel words that could be used. Wouldn't you like to have a name? Where do you live? I live in Gergesa or Gergesa. Would you please say that again? You know, it sounds like an ad for Listerine. When he had come out of the boat, there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit who lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, even with a chain, for he'd often been bound with fetters and chains, but the chains he wrenched apart and the fetters he broke in pieces, and no one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and bruising himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and worshipped him, and crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him eagerly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of swine was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, "Send us to the swine, let us enter them." So he gave them leave, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the swine, and the whole herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea. Whew. That's an action-filled paragraph, isn't it? What's one word in that paragraph that leaps right out? Just one word. It's a title. Legion. All right. Legion. Legion. Or you could call this Gadarene demoniac or Gerasene demoniac or Gergesene demoniac, but legion will do. It's the only time the word legion occurs in the Gospel of Mark. Now, the next paragraph isn't quite as easy to title. Verse 14. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demoniac sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, the man who had had the legion, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it told what had happened to the demoniac and to the swine, and they began to beg Jesus to depart from their neighborhood. And as he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him, but he refused and said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he's had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all men marveled. The paragraph's a little bit more difficult to title, and the reason why it's difficult is there are three things going on. One is the herdsmen flee. Two, the man has an encounter with Jesus. Four, Jesus sends the man away. So when you've got that much action occurring within a paragraph, it's more difficult to title. I just simply call it, from the first phrase, herdsmen flee. And that sort of does it to me. When I say herdsmen flee, I can think of the rest of it. So we have now sea storm, legion, herdsmen flee, and we've memorized the first 20 verses of chapter 435 through 520. That's rather easy, isn't it? Okay, let's finish it up. Verse 21, the next paragraph. When Jesus had crossed again into the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and besought him, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. Who's the central person other than Jesus in this? Jairus. Okay, what's he doing? He's making a plea. Okay. He's making a plea. He's making a request. So it could be Jairus' plea or Jairus' request. Now the word request is not in the text, but I suppose we could substitute it there. Jairus is asking Jesus to do something. Then the next paragraph begins in the middle of a verse. See how here the verse doesn't do an adequate job of dividing the paragraph unit. A great crowd followed him and thronged about him, and there was a woman who had had a flow of blood for 12 years. And who had suffered much under many physicians. Who in here has had that experience? Has suffered much under many physicians. In one service this morning, we had four dentists present in that service. And I thought of this text. Who had suffered much under many physicians. And it's been all she had. Well, you do that too, you know. And was no better off, but grew worse. And she had heard reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment, for she said, "If I touch even his garments, I will be made well." And immediately the hemorrhage ceased, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone forth from him, immediately turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had been done to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." central person in this story is a what? A woman. And what, you know, there's many women that Jesus will minister to in the course of his earthly ministry. So what separates her from all the others? It's a long word that begins with H. She is hemorrhaging. So hemorrhaging woman would be an easy way to remember this particular unit of thought. Aren't you excited so far that you feel spiritually blessed for knowing this? This is always, you know, the fundamentals of Bible study. You know, when a football team, what makes a Super Bowl winner or number one football team in the country or any kind of a sport? It's because they always do the fundamentals exceedingly well. They don't do the fancy passes or the Statue of Liberty plays, except first of all, they've learned how to block and tackle and all those good kinds of things. And this is the same way with Bible study. You start out by just doing the fundamentals. Then the last paragraph in this section is, while he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But ignoring what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, he saw a tumult and people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a tumult and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside. He'll get the last laugh. And took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, and now Mark is still hearing Aramaic. Okay, remember, Peter probably is the source for the Gospel of Mark. And Peter could never really translate what Jesus said because he would always hear it in Aramaic. Talitha kumai, which means little girl. And by the way, you can tell Mark is writing to people that don't know Aramaic because he immediately has to turn around and translate it. Which means, little girl, I say to you, arise. And immediately the girl got up and walked. She was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. Okay, who's the central figure of this other than Jesus? It is what? Jairus' daughter. So Jairus' daughter raised. Of Jairus' request in an earlier paragraph, Jairus' daughter raised. So we walk through now this section and we've got, let's go through the titles. We've got the first title, 435, is Sea Storm. Then we have Legion. Then we have Herdsman Flee. Then we have Jairus' Request. Then we have Hemorrhaging Woman. And then we have Jairus' Daughter Raised. Great! So you got it all. 7 paragraphs. You already know that. We can just go home now, okay? All over and done with. What ties these paragraphs together? What kind of action is happening here? What joins these as a common theme? Miracles, all right? Healings, miracles. So we ought to certainly call this miracles. Have you noticed how many miracles are there in this passage? From 435 through the end of chapter 5, how many specific miracles? Now there are 7 paragraphs, I think. So 6 or 7. How many miracles? Count them. There is first, storm at sea. Second miracle is legion. Third miracle is the woman. And the fourth miracle is Jairus' daughter raised. 4 miracles, all right? Have you noticed that each of these miracles fall into a different category? For example, the miracle of the storm at sea is a miracle that shows Jesus' power over nature. The miracle of the Gadarene demoniacs, or demoniac, we'll comment on the difference between demoniacs and demoniac in just a minute, that is a manifestation of Jesus' power over demons. The third miracle is a manifestation of Jesus' power over illness, and therefore is a healing, not an exorcism, but a healing. And the fourth miracle is a miracle over death itself. 4 distinct categories of miracle. We might therefore call this whole section, when it's all put together, simply selected miracles. What Mark has done is take an example from the 4 realms in which Jesus did mighty works. He takes one example from each of the 4 realms and gives you an outstanding testimony. If you look at all the miracles Jesus did, you'll find that all of his miracles can be boiled down to these 4 categories. Miracles over nature, miracles over illness, miracles over demon possession, miracles over death. In fact, if you want to take the time to do this, or get a harmony of the Gospels if you don't want to take time to do it individually, but count the specific miracles that the Gospels report that Jesus did. And if you don't allow for any duplication, Like, for example, the feeding of the 5,000 is a miracle that happens in all four Gospels. Just count it once instead of occurring four times. If you count all the miracles, and including the duplication accounts in the Gospels, and boil them down to just one, you have, when it's all reduced, the Gospels report 35 specific acts of power or miracles that Jesus did in his earthly ministry. Of these 35 miracles, they fall into these four categories. 18 belong in the realm of illness or healing. That is, one over half belong in the area of healings. Of the healing miracles, those further subdivide into two categories, acute illness and chronic illness. Acute illness is something that suddenly happens to you. You weren't sick, but now you've got a fever of 105 degrees. Acute miracle is something like Peter's mother-in-law had. She came down ill with a fever. And then there's chronic illness, which is, you know, it goes on and on. Like, for example, blindness or deafness or leprosy. It's a condition. And therefore, you know, the healings in the Gospels are not psychosomatic healings because they occur out of the 18 physical healing miracles. 13 of them are occurring in the chronic realm of lameness, of paralysis, of blindness, deafness, leprosy, etc. So that's one category. And what Mark does is take one of the outstanding examples of physical illness, the hemorrhaging woman, to serve as an example of Jesus' power over illness. Then there are 9 miracles, of all the 35 miracles in the Gospel, 9 miracles that attest to his power over nature. How are you going to know that he is the Lord who made the heavens and the earth? Well, how would you know a Michelangelo if he came into the room? He'd paint a painting for us. And we would look at it, and wouldn't it be nice if he would come in and paint our ceiling here? And we would look up and say, oh, God reaching down, ready to put life into Adam, must be Michelangelo. We would know him if he did a creative work. And so we have the nature miracles, water to wine, loaves and fishes, and now this storm at sea. And by the way, there's a tremendous miracle of communication taking place here. I mean, Jesus simply speaks to the elements and they obey him. I wish I could have that kind of power just in human communication. Wouldn't you like to talk to your parents and get them to do what you want them to do? Wouldn't you like your wife to do what you want her to do? Or how about your husband? I'd settle for my dog obeying me, you know. Sunshine, don't wet your diaper, you know. So if you're in the church, you know all about Sunshine and the fact that he is psychologically ill and has worn a diaper for some time. By the way, one of the beautiful things that the staff and the board did for Christmas, the Christmas gift to the pastor this year, was a monogrammed diaper with the name Sunshine, our dog's name, monogrammed into the diaper. It was a real token of love and esteem and respect from the leadership of the church. I can't get my dog to obey me, you know. Here the power of Jesus is speaking through the elements. There's a built-in receiving instrument within nature itself to hear the voice of the Son of God, even if he's speaking Aramaic. It's a built-in thing there within nature to hear the voice of the Son of God and line up and obey it. It's an amazing thing. 5 of the Lord's miracles are in respect to demon possession. And 3 of his miracles, the smallest category, is in respect to death. Jairus' daughter, who had been dead for hours, the widow's son at Nain, who had been dead for a day, and Lazarus, who had been dead for four days. They come as Jesus' ministry progresses in increasing levels of intensity. Those are the 4 miracles, categories of miracle, and Mark simply gives us an example, an outstanding example of each category of the Lord's authority and power. Now, why do I go into that? Because if you do some comparison, you will find by comparing Luke's gospel, I think it's Luke 8, with Matthew 8, with Mark chapter 4 and 5, where these miracles are all reported, you'll find that there is a difference in chronology. That Mark and Luke together report all 4 miracles as one after another. But when Mark is reporting the miracles, the first two, the storm at sea and the legion, he has that, and then there is a rearrangement of the material so that in chapter 9, then he has the paralytic healed, and he has the call of Matthew, and he has the paragraphs on feasting and fasting, and then he comes down to the hemorrhaging woman and to Jairus' daughter. In other words, Matthew takes the material in the early part of Mark 2 and jams it into what we would say is the middle of Mark chapter 5. And we look at this, you know, and our tendency right away is to say, wow, I thought the Bible was inerrant. that it was infallible. And here when I'm reading the chronology, it's a break. It's a clear, obvious break in chronology. The two Gospels do not track together in the same chronology. So what is happening? We look at that and we say, well, what could be? If you'll allow me this illustration, I think I can relate what's happening. A bunch of us some of us went to the Holy Land this last year, and I've made 6 trips to the Holy Land now, and I have enough pictures to entertain you from the Holy Land for any number of years. In fact, I finally gave up taking pictures altogether and just started buying postcards because they look so much better than my pictures, and I'm assembling them all in a book, and they're going to be wonderful when I get done. I won't tell you how many rolls of film one of the people on the trip took this year, but I think it was nearing a couple of dozen 36-picture rolls, quite a few films. Now, John says an interesting thing in his gospel. He says that Jesus did so many things that they're all written down in a book the world itself couldn't contain. That is, there were hundreds and hundreds of miracles. So the gospel writers are, in effect, literary photographers. They have taken snapshots. They know all the photos, and they're all spread out. And the Holy Spirit, in having them write, is saying to them, now, use this one, use this one, use this one, use this one. Put it in your carousel, slide, your literary slide tray. And the Holy Spirit, in His wisdom, has let the authors arrange, on occasion, the order in which those slides occur. And the order may be determined not by the chronology in which the events occurred, but may also be ordered by the particular topic that the gospel writer at that moment is attempting to trace. So, you find in Mark, who is highly topical at times. Mark is at a simple point in his development of the gospel where he wants to talk about the miracles of Jesus. So he's not nearly as chronologically conscious as we are, and he does the same thing that you may do if you're on a trip. You may go through Jerusalem, for example, and take all the slides and pop them up on the screen to show how chronologically you went from day to day in Jerusalem. Only you may have laced back and forth here and there. You could show them chronologically, or you could come back and say, now here are all the shots of the wall. I know I took some shots on Monday and some on Wednesday and some on Thursday, but I lumped them all together. These are the shots of the wall. And these are the shots of the Temple Mount. This is the shots of the old city, and so forth. The gospel writers have done the same thing. And probably in Matthew's gospel, we find the correct chronological order. Matthew's gospel is simply the topical formulation, the carousel that has some liberty of arrangement. And it doesn't at all destroy the doctrine of infallibility of Scripture and inerrancy. It just has to do with knowing what the writers are up to when they write. Isn't that all exciting now? All right, still with me? Let's dive a little bit into the text now. And let's talk first of all about the storm at sea. It's just like Jesus. To get us into the problems when we're dead tired. You ever find that your greatest tests often come when you're the most bummed out? You know, you don't have really the strength to deal with what's going on, and all of a sudden the circumstances of life are such that you get pushed into something you don't think you're up to. And be nice if after a busy day where Jesus has taught the crowds, and remember that the disciples are all the time having to be crowd control experts. I mean, their muscles have got to be sore with people poking all day, and they're trying to, you know, then they're on the boat trying to study it so Jesus can have a platform from which to speak. They're just exhausted. Jesus said, let's get to the other side. And they got in, and he's so zonked. I mean, you talk about the humanity of Jesus. Boy, if you want to talk about the humanity of Jesus, find out if he's a real human being, just look at the Gospel of Mark. Jesus gets in the boat and falls sound asleep and is so... He reminds me of me when I fall sound asleep. Nothing in heaven or earth can wake him up. You know, he is in the middle of this storm asleep, and Mark tells us a little detail that none of the other gospel writers include, and it's the fact that he is asleep on a cushion or on a pillow. Just a little detail there. Interesting. Why don't any other gospel writers pick it up? Who knows? But one of the things, of course, about the Gospel of Mark is that if Peter stands behind Mark, that is, if Mark is writing down what Peter preached, as is the common assumption that is involved in Mark's gospel, and one of the reasons why, by the way, we believe that Peter does stand behind the Gospel of Mark is that everywhere in the other Gospels where Peter looks good, in Mark it's downplayed or omitted altogether. He doesn't puff himself up. I could make a lot of comments on that, but I'll hasten on. I was going to say some things that were just unnecessary. But I was going to comment on those who use the ministry as an opportunity to brag about themselves. I remember once a colleague in his prayer, pulpit prayer on Sunday morning, managing to tell the congregation his travel background and ministry and all the great places he'd been in the last 3 months. Somehow that got sneaked into the prayer. So religious orators can be sometimes a vain lot, unfortunately. That may be why they're in public, because they have ego problems. But that's not true of most, but maybe true of some. But Peter always downplays himself. Why did I get off on that? It has nothing to do. Where were we? Oh, yeah, on a pillow. He's on a pillow. And it's as though, the eyewitness is coming straight through. I mean, Peter was the one that probably got him up, and he still remembers what his head was lying on. If you want, to me, this is, J.B. Phillips has a book called The Ring of Truth, in which he talks about when you read the Gospels, there come those tremendous moments when you know that there is such a ring of authenticity and eyewitness character to them that nobody could have fabricated that kind of thing. And it just strikes you to the heart that this is the real stuff. I mean, who would have thought if they're making up a story to have that little detail in there? It's Peter's way of saying, I remember, he had his head on something soft. And he's asleep. And Galilee is raging. Now, I'm going to close tonight with a devotional from this particular instance, so I won't go overboard on it now. Lake Galilee is also called the Lake of Chinnereth, which means a harp. And it's shaped like a harp. From the air, it sort of looks like a biblical harp. It's 15 miles long, and it's north-south widest points, and about 7 miles wide at its widest point. And it's a lake that has mountains all around it. It's the lowest freshwater lake on earth. It's about 700 feet below the level of the sea. And surrounded by mountains, when the Mediterranean winds come, it funnels through the Arabelle, through the mountain chain, and can whip up even today. Obviously, the wind conditions are the same today. Terrible, terrible storms at certain times of the year. They rise suddenly and can dissipate suddenly. The disciples are caught in that moment, and they become panicky. They wake the Lord up. I doubt that they have in mind at all that He's going to do a miracle. I think they were sort of upset that He was sleeping while they were bailing water like crazy. And they simply want Him to grab a pail like everybody else. Master, don't you care if we perish? How can you sleep? But he gets up and does a very profound thing. He speaks to the elements because he has this ability to communicate to them, and they quiet down. And then he rebukes the disciples because they didn't have faith. Why should they have had faith? Because Jesus had begun that segment by saying, "Let us go across to the other side." It was his assurance. We're going across to the other side. And in the middle of the storm, they forgot the word of the Lord. And that's really what faith is all about. Faith is remembering what Jesus said, even when he says it calmly. Jesus didn't stand on the shore and say, "Now, we're going to the other side." Say it after me. "We're going to the other side." Now, 1, 2, 3. We're going to the other side. Everybody raise your hands and say, "Hallelujah, we're going to the other side." Come on now, let's get some enthusiasm up. Jesus didn't do that at all with these disciples. He just said, kind of in an offhanded way, "We're going to the other side." In the middle of the storm, they forgot He said that. And when you forget what Jesus has said, you can't have faith. Fear will dominate. And so he rebukes them and says, "Don't you have faith?" They didn't have grain of mustard seed faith. They had no faith. They thought they were lost. You look back upon that now and you say, how stupid of the disciples. I mean, how could the boat have gone down? The Lord of heaven and earth was on the boat. There's no way it could have sunk because He'd have gone down with it. But it's nice for us to be armchair critics. There are moments in life when we feel like we're sinking. And that's when we ought to look more seriously at what the disciples are feeling. Well, he gets across the other side and there's this wild man from Gadara. Now, in the scriptures, you can see that there are gradations of demon possession. Why do I say that? Because this man was way gone. He lived among the tombs. Anybody that lives in tombs has got to have, some things wrong in their personality. And he'd been tied down many times, but he had superhuman strength. And he was punishing himself, bruising himself with stones. And he was always crying out night and day. And he was also without clothes. The madman of Gadara. Now I submit to you that there's a great deal of difference between his condition and Mark chapter 1, Jesus' first miracle that Mark records in the synagogue at Capernaum. Remember, Jesus begins his ministry and suddenly while he's preaching there came a man who said, "What have you to do with us, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." That man in the synagogue at Capernaum was normal enough and regular enough to at least get in a worship audience such as this. But in the presence of Jesus, he erupted. This guy at Gadara was so wild he would have never fit in any synagogue. I mean, he was just uncontrollable. So there are gradations in possession. I had people say, what's the difference between possession and mental illness? Isn't this a... You know, there are some who look at the Gospels and say, the Gospels are a classic misreading of human illness. That what we have in the Gospels, in people in those days were superstitious and they were, you know, simpler educationally than we are, and so they simply misdiagnosed schizophrenia or mental illness for demon possession, and everything had a demon behind it. I beg to differ with you. When the person is mentally ill, and mental illness is a very real thing, you don't cast something out of a mentally ill person. It doesn't go into a herd of pigs and stampede down the sea. When a person is possessed, they have an alien spirit within them. Hey, I can't, you know, in 1987, maybe when I was growing up, people doubted demon possession. But I mean, we're talking about 1987 when Shirley MacLaine is talking about channeling. And she's taught by a guy that's had a spirit, supposedly Ramatha, who's 35,000 years old. And he's made a lot of money off that spirit, too. It must be a kind of a wealthy, familiar spirit. But, you know, our country is getting into demon possession. You know, I think C.S. Lewis was so right. C.S. Lewis says the devil is smart enough to adapt his strategy to fit the culture. And the fact is that in Western culture, our emphasis has been upon ideas and technology. So the devil has infiltrated our idea system. And we do not recognize things as demonic, such as, for example, secular humanism or playboy philosophy, hedonism or Marxism or the like. All those are manifestations, C.S. Lewis says, of the demonic in our culture. But since the demonic has invaded the realm of ideas, we don't see it. But in the East, where people engage in meditation and personal absorption and the like, the demons enter into that capacity and become personally possessive of an individual. So if you're in the Orient or in India or a place like that, you see a great manifestation of demon possession because people are into mysticism and contemplation and mantras and the like. I think what we're seeing in America right now is the East crossing the West, and there is now a moving into our culture of personal possession that is far greater in 1987 than it was when I was a young person back in the 40s and 50s and early 60s. This person is... Like all the demon-possessed people, he immediately recognizes who Jesus is, and he's torn. The human side of him is wanting to be free. The demonic side is begging Jesus, and Luke makes an interesting comment. Luke here says that he begged him, that is, begged Jesus, not to send them into the abyss. A-B-Y-S-S. Into the abyss. And when you're dealing with the plagues of the book of Revelation and you see in the end time a demonic plague come upon mankind, the demons arise out of the abyss. That is, the Bible presents the idea that underneath the earth there is a sort of a demon pit, a holding place for demons. Now I know in the Western mind again we say, oh come on, you know, demon pits. One of the strategies of the devil is to, in our day, make Western-oriented people think that he doesn't exist. He's the only major world power I know of whose basic foreign policy goal is to convince people he doesn't exist. And you're nutty and cakey and religious and all that if you believe in the devil. Believe it or not, my uncle, who ministered in a demon-possessed culture, Tibet's probably the most demon-possessed, ridden culture in the world because they literally worship the devil. He built his house over... You can choose to believe this or not to believe this, but over demon pits, hollowed out cylinder-like places in the ground that were about 4 to 5 feet, and there was no reason why that land should be hollowed other than it had been a place where literally demons had been worshipped, and the Tibetans wouldn't have anything to do with the property, so they sold it to my uncle. He simply cleansed the ground and built his house there. You can believe that or not believe it. To the abyss. Don't send us to the abyss. So Jesus gave them leave. And they came out of the man entered a swine that was feeding on the hillside, and they ran down the hill and perished in the sea. Now you look at that. Now let's look at that for a moment from a Western point of view and say, wow, what's Jesus doing here? He's taking a pig farmer's property and destroying it. I mean, if you own 2,000 pig, what's pig going for? What's a pound of pork now? Anybody know? Ham, I don't know what it is. $3.50 a pound? How big is a pig, you know? 400 pounds? I mean, you know, that's a lot of 2,000 pigs, my goodness. I shouldn't tell this story, but it reminds me of the... No, I better not. Oh, no, I really shouldn't do this. This is strictly now for all the junior high kids here. This young preacher that went on a call to farmers in his parish who raised animals and farmed crops and stuff like that, and they had a pet pig in the house. And they treated it just like a pet dog. It's a very smart, very clean animal, and they kept bragging on how good their pig was and how they loved it and how it was cleaner than a dog and a cat and more well-behaved and all this. The preacher was just amazed, you know, about this beautiful pig, but he noticed that the pig had a wood leg, backwood leg. And the preacher finally, his curiosity said, you know, you love this pig. It's amazing how much you love him. You've even given him a wood leg. What happened with his leg? And the family said, oh, we love this pig so much we just decided to eat him a little bit at a time. I told you I should have told that story. Savor when I stick with notes. You know, there have been some people that have looked at this story in the Gospels and have said, boy, oh boy, was there many a rejoicing in the Orthodox quarters when the word got around that Jesus had wiped out a pig farm. Do you know that in Israel today, this is an interesting thing, when you're in Israel, it is forbidden by the Israeli government for pigs to be raised in Israel. And that's against the law. Okay? You can have your pigs confiscated if you're raising pigs. But yet, the consumption of pig meat is a very big industry in Israel. And there are pig farms in Israel by Jewish farmers, pig farms today. The Orthodox rail against this. The Ministry of Agriculture, and this I'm just telling you stuff I read in the Jerusalem Post. The Ministry of Agriculture, Minister of Agriculture, was asked point blank in a press conference how many pig farms and how many pigs there were in Israel being raised by Jews. And he said, there are none in our records. And the reporters openly laughed in the press session. Because there are pig farms, only they're not called pigs, and the meat is not called pig meat, it's called white meat. It's very popular in Israel among non-observant Jews. Pigs are eaten all the time. So some have said what Jesus is doing here is endorsing the Orthodox community view of staying away from swine. But we know that Jesus, you know, allowed his disciples to eat on the Sabbath, and he had a general disregard for Pharisaic interpretation of things. And besides, this is in the area across the sea where the Gentiles lived, and it was probably Gentile pigs, you know, that were involved in. So I doubt that that was the reason. And I have thought and thought about this, you know, because it looks like a wanton destruction that Jesus allowed of property. And what's he doing in allowing this to happen? And it struck me as I was going through the text that the real key to understanding what happened is to note the reaction of the townspeople to the healing of the demoniac. And when they see him sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, instead of rejoicing, instead of being happy about it, they do what? They beg Jesus eagerly to depart out of their neighborhood. And that is really the key to why I think Jesus allowed the destruction of property. It had to do with the value that the townspeople held. If you'd had a ballot in Gadara or Gerasa or Gergesa, whichever you call it, if you'd had a ballot, election day, November the 4th, and you'd have had vote for one of two things on the ballot. Vote for people or for pigs. Can't have both. You can have one or the other. You can keep your pigs, see the guy keep suffering out there, or you can see him healed and lose your pigs. Which would you vote for? It's obvious the people of Gadara would have voted for pigs every day because their value was not on the person, it was on things and property. And Jesus simply, like it or not, is scrambling our ethical and moral values and telling us that people are always more important than things and property. That doesn't mean that he just endorses wanton destruction of property, but he's saying when your values of life are that things are more important than people, then you're all messed up in your values and you need to get things straight. And Jesus for sure was not messed up in his values. At least that's my guess as to what's going on in the text. Now, if you notice Matthew's Gospel, you'll find in Matthew's Gospel a difference in the account. Matthew talks about there being two demoniacs. Mark and Luke only talk about one. Why this divergence? Is the Gospel writer simply messed up? They got the story all scrambled and people talk about that are serious students of the Bible who are critics of the Bible say, well, now here is another example of glaring inconsistency and contradiction. Matthew has two demoniacs, Mark and Luke have one. Both can't be right. Oh, sure they can. Sure they can. The key, literally, is if you look at Mark and Luke's text, you'll find that in their account, there is a longer treatment. And they go on to talk about the man who goes into the Decapolis. That's a wide-ranging area of consisting of 10 Greek cities, non-Jewish Gentile cities, and shared how much the Lord had done for him. What happened was something like this. Matthew takes his camera shot, if he's a Holy Spirit literary photographer, okay? He backs off and takes a panoramic shot of the whole thing. Mark and Luke come in with a zoom lens right on the one. And why are they concerned about the one? Because he is the one of the two who went out and did something with his healing. He talked about it until everybody in the Decapolis heard. He became an evangelist. And so Mark and Luke center and focus upon him because evidently the other person was simply delivered and then did nothing after that. In fact, this one demoniac, Mark reports, says to Jesus, "Let me go with you." He begged him that he might go with him. And surprisingly, Jesus doesn't allow him to do it. He says to him, I think the hardest word Jesus ever said to anybody, if you ask me what's the hardest word Jesus ever said to a disciple, it almost has to be here. Go home and tell your friends how much the Lord has done for you. So he fades into history as a nameless person. If he'd have been allowed to come with Jesus, we'd have known his name like we knew Peter's and Andrew's and Mark's and John and all the rest. But Jesus says, no, you go home and tell what the Lord has done for you. And I think in that, we see a marvelous application that for most of us, the call of Jesus on our life is not to go to Africa, not to go to India, not to go to China. The call for us is to go home, to go to work, to go to school, to go back to the everyday common task in life, and within the midst of that everyday ordinary common task of life, to minister and lift up the name of Jesus. And it'd be far more glamorous, maybe, if we could all go somewhere else and share Christ. But for most of us, the Lord simply says, go home and tell what the Lord has done. Well, that passes then into these other instances of the woman with the hemorrhage. She is such a classic example of a person who has faith. She doesn't let her 12-year condition get her down. She believes Jesus can overrule the physicians. By the way, Mark and Luke do an interesting thing here. Mark says she'd spent all her living on physicians. And Luke, being the doctor, now Luke is always noting medical details, remember. He remembers that Peter's mother-in-law had the high fever, that the man with the withered hand, it was his right hand, that the man with leprosy was full of leprosy. He's the diagnostician. And Luke is not about to let doctors take the brunt end of everything. So he makes an additional statement that only Luke makes, that no doctor could help her, meaning her disease was beyond what any cure any physician could give. He defends the trade. She presses through. Now, you have to read Leviticus 15 alongside of Mark 5 to get the real imprint of this story. Because in Leviticus 15, this woman was disqualified from being in public because she was ceremonially unclean. She had an unstopped flow of blood, a hemorrhaging condition, which under the Levitical law rendered her in a ceremonial condition of impurity, which meant that whatever she touched, if she touched this, and I came along and touched it that day, I too became impure. And if I were impure, it meant that I must abstain from temple worship. It meant that I too must stay in my house until the evening when I could take a bath, a mikvah, an immersion, and cleanse myself. It meant to abstain from normal human relationships, including sexual relationships. So anything she touched or any person she touched became unclean. She comes out of that condition of uncleanness. And here are all these Pharisees and scribes believing they're keeping God's law, you know, surrounding Jesus. And this little lady's coming through the crowd, pushing people aside, you know. Defiling people left and right. They don't even know it, you know. And she knows when she touches Jesus that she is in violation of that Leviticus 15 ordinance about touching the clean thing. He's clean. He's pure. And always Uncleanness worked that way. In the Old Testament, whatever was unclean that touched something clean contaminated the clean thing. It was never something clean uncontaminated the unclean. It was always the unclean contaminated the clean. But when she touches Jesus, who is clean? He stops. And the disciples just think it's ridiculous in a pressing crowd like that that he would ask who touched him. But he felt power go out of him. And he said, "Who touched me?" She, knowing that he meant her, and fearing that he would now call her into task for having defiled her, says, "Lord, it was me." And he says, "Daughter." It's interesting in the Gospels, there are only three people that Jesus calls by specific titles. One person he calls a son, one person he calls a technon, which means child, and the third person he calls a daughter. And all three of them, namely Zacchaeus, whom he called a son, the rooftop paralytic, whom he called technon or child, and this woman, whom he calls daughter, all three of them were people who regarded themselves as standing outside of relationship with God. Zacchaeus, because he was a tax collector and not godly at all, Jesus calls him son. The man, the paralytic, who was filled with sin, who did not regard himself as God's child, whom Jesus called technon or child, and this woman who felt isolated and away from God, Jesus calls her thugater, daughter. And isn't that like the Lord in dealing with us, to call us something which we say in our life, how could I ever be a child of God or a son of God or a daughter of God? Well, he just calls the most unlikely people those kinds of titles. He really loves people. And Jesus teaches her something that's so very important. He's saying, hey, when the unclean touches the clean, and I am the clean, the energy is reversed. There's a whole different reversal of energy flow. Nothing unclean can contaminate me. I can take the sin of the whole world. And when I take the sin of the whole world, what's going to happen is I'm going to take that negative energy which is being given to me, and I'm going to turn it around, and I'm going to pass my purity back into that which is unclean and that which is sinful. And so this woman serves as a great model for us of what happens when our own personal uncleanness hits the Lord. He takes it, and he turns right around and jams back righteousness and purity into our lives. Marvelous thing. And then there's Jairus' daughter, the little girl who just died. And this is Jesus first raising from the dead. Notice he puts all the unbelievers out of the room. And he takes three, Peter, James, and John, in the room and says to her, "Talitha kumai, little girl, I say to you, rise." Just one thing I want to say about that. And by the way, notice that the girl was 12 years of age and the woman had had the flow of blood 12 years of age. They're sort of linked structurally together because of the word 12. But one interesting thing, if you flip over to Acts chapter 9 and see Peter's ministry, after the day of Pentecost, Peter has been ministering in the area outside of Jerusalem, and he comes to a place called Joppa, where there is a deaconess, we'd call her deaconess today, by the name of Dorcas, whose Aramaic name was Tabitha. And she had did all kinds of good works. And she died. And Peter, when he came upon the scene, found all the widows weeping because their Tabitha, their Dorcas, was dead. And Peter, here, it's almost as if there's a sense of deja vu. A sense of being back in the scene, because Peter at that moment sort of goes into, well, I had this happen. I was in once before a situation like this. And Jesus put all the wailers out. And he went in and he bent over the lifeless form and he said, "Talitha kumai." And I really, by the way, think that's how the gift of faith worked. The gift of faith works when we've seen it happen somewhere else. We come in and then we have strong courage to bring it to bear on the present need. Peter comes in and he doesn't say "Talitha kumai," he says "Tabitha." Just changes one word. Instead of T-A-L, it's T-A-B. "Tabitha kumai." And she rises up from the dead. The training that Jesus had gotten in Jairus' daughter's house becomes applicable in Peter's later ministry. As it always happens, when we are around that which builds faith and builds courage and builds discipleship, then we have it ourselves when we need it. So the Lord is moving on these fronts in life. Miracle over nature, a miracle over demons, a miracle over illness, and a miracle over death. If I had a lot more time, I'd love to talk to you about demonic possession and the like. I think we may have occasion yet later in Mark. I felt I wanted to close tonight. I dug something out that I wrote. I can't hardly believe this, but I wrote this 22 years ago. And it became my observation and what Jesus was doing in the storm at sea. And I just felt impressed to read it to you tonight. It takes me about 12 or 13 minutes probably. But it is a way of looking at this great miracle. One of my favorite spot in all this world is dead center in the Lake of Galilee, just being there. And long before I ever got there, God had given me a kind of an interpretation of how we apply the lesson of that storm to our own lives. And I just pray as I share this evening that it may speak to you if you're going through a situation that in any way parallels what these disciples went through. Remember that this is coming now from a 23 or 24-year-old, so it has all the limitations that that age may represent. God has appointed limits, boundaries for all things. Nothing can infinitely continue unless He allows it. All things earthly have their appointed season. The most excruciating pain, the most loathsome disease, the despondency of soul have limits, boundaries beyond which they cannot pass. They may tarry so long, no longer. God has appointed limits for all things. High winds have limits. Mankind has learned through long experience that no wind can blow forever and that no storm can endlessly continue. The high winds, while raging, may be fierce. They may batter land and sea and man. They may wreak untold havoc, leaving in their wake battered towns and blown down trees. But high winds must pass. High winds do not blow everywhere at once, nor do they blow anywhere in one place forever. A storm had risen on the Sea of Galilee, a storm of high winds. The storm might blow for hours, even days, but what if it blew longer? Permit that storm to keep its fury and collect adhesive force, and it will soon affect more than Galilee's sea. The unspent winds will gather and gather. Hurricane force will be added to hurricane force, tornado funnel to tornado funnel. Grant the flying storm a fury and foment long enough time and the ability to gather momentum, and the world could be destroyed. But high winds have limits. They may blow so far, only so long. High winds are fought. The disciples in the boat, the other fishers on the lake, the boats round about, were not at all concerned with the truth. High winds have limits. Mathematical odds favored the storm's disintegrating before morning. Small assurance. Let that storm continue only minutes longer, and they would not be around to witness its dissolution. Their leaking boat was listing dangerously, driven recklessly, hurled about furiously. One concern was theirs. Bail water fast. Keep the boat floating until the high winds are conquered by the limits. High winds have limits. High winds are fought. How many are the high winds of life? Speak to the man who lies on a bed of illness, racked by 1,000 instruments of pain. Join in conversation with the soul who is passing through the dark valley of despair, racked by the high winds of inner doubt, inferiority, insecurity, unbearable sorrow, disillusioned hope. Stand by the side of a disappointed lover or a grief-stricken husband. In normal days, they know high winds have limits, that sickness has an ending, that doubts do go away, that grief has termination. But little assurance, little comfort fills our heart when the day of high winds comes. The high winds must be fought. The unseen elements must be wrestled with. Meager power must join conflict with insurmountable opposition. The fight is ever to last it out until the high winds have passed. High winds call forth desperate voices. Only when hope is fading fast, only when human strength will not avail, only when the demon elements drive us without mercy, only then do we cry aloud, "Master, carest thou not if we perish?" Desperate voices arise when the familiar threatens. In your meditation on this ancient record of that Galilean sea storm, take care that you do not look at the disciples disdainfully. Do not laugh. Do not call them cowards. Do not make light of their danger. This was not the first time they had sailed a ship. This was not their first journey across that lake. This was not their first storm. These were men of the sea. Hour by hour, day by day, year in and year out, they had sailed under azure skies upon blue-green water. They knew the Lake of Galilee, its harbors, its deep points, its sandbars, its shoals, its dangers. Sailing was old hat to them. They were mature men, experienced fishers. No ordinary wind would frighten them. But it was night, black night. 1,000 hells were raging round their ship. 1,000 furies leaped and beat them, backed away and beat again. No light, no compass, no hope for the storm to quickly end. What a change! What a sudden change. The sea, so familiar to them, had suddenly become an uncharted expanse. The sea that provided them with a livelihood had now become their greatest enemy. That which they were most used to had become that which they could no longer handle. We all get used to life. We all get settled in our ways. We all dwell in the rut of the common. We know how to make the most of fair days, but how often that with which we are most familiar becomes suddenly our greatest anxiety. Our homes, peaceful and serene, full of Christian faith and love, suddenly destroyed. Our loved ones, patient, dear, full of life and hope, suddenly cut down. Our health, taken for granted, thoughtlessly enjoyed, in a moment, gone. How sudden are the high winds? How urgent are the desperate voices? Perishing, perishing, Master, carest thou not if we perish? If desperate voices call when the familiar threatens, so also desperate voices call from the strongest of people. The disciples were men of physical strength. To keep up with Jesus, you had to be strong. In the midst of the high winds, every muscle is taut. Every effort that can be spent is being spent. All hands are bailing water. Water that was swamping the boat. Water pouring in from the raging sea. All their strength was being brought to bear on that situation. But their strength was not enough. On land, they could easily have lasted out the battering of the storm. Why, on land, their legs could run to shelter from the lashing gale. But their strength now was weakness, and they were weak because they were in the boat. That boat floated upon the waters in days of calm. On many a lazy afternoon, it had carried its passengers well across a glass smooth sea. But it is in the storm, when the waves are beating high, when life is caught in the swell and swamp of breaking hostile force, that the boat shows its weakness. The boat, says Mark, was already filling. Never boast of strength. Never believe you are indestructible or untemptable. Never think even for a moment that there is no situation which you cannot master in your own power. God may place you in a boat and try your faith. God may put you in a situation you cannot escape, where all your powers and all your abilities are locked within the boat and you cannot get to safer shores. In spite of your own strength, high winds and a leaking boat may lead you to utter desperate words. Desperate voices often fail in giving the solution. Master, do you not care if we perish? Are they not really saying, wake up, help us bail water. One more hand may make the difference. Jesus, fit it into our prescribed pattern. It's an emergency. Do it our way. If Jesus would only follow the directions we give him, if he would only take our pail. But what to him is a pail? A desperate voice calls forth when the familiar threatens, and it calls forth from the strongest of men. Desperate voices also call forth with loudness and brevity. Have you ever been on a lake on a fair day? Then you know how far the voice travels. You can hear the normal conversation in a boat furlongs away, or you can call from far out to a friend on the bank and be heard easily. In speaking to the large crowds, Jesus often taught them by the sea. Certainly, they could hear him better. Peter and his crew were old hands around the sea. On clear and sunny days, they fished in their boats or cleaned their nets, and their banter back and forth from boat to boat and within the boat served to break the stillness of the lakeside quiet. How relaxed is the voice in balmy days. How easily it carries. How endlessly and effortlessly does it give forth words. But have you ever been in a storm at sea? Have you ever been in a small fishing vessel in the dead of night, when the billows of the deep and the winds of wildness meet on the surface of the lake and churn the once moonlit waters into boiling waves of ambition? The noise of water meeting wind, of near and distant thunderclaps, of mountainous foam breaking in continuous roar, fills the once still silence. Stand now on the deck and call to the little boat only yards away. Is it well? How goes the ship? Ahoy! Ahoy! Stand closer to the rail. Cup your hands again. Call more mightily. Ahoy! Is it well? But the high winds have carried away your voice, and no one else can hear. The disciples found this so. The other little ships were with them, but they were beyond communication. The storm was battering and tossing, heaving and weaving their small boat in and out and among the slamming waves. The thunder of the waves roaring, the whipping of the mighty gale, the boiling waters beating stern and prow blotted out all other sounds. And the loudest shout was only a whisper, the whisper of desperate voices. Master, do you not care if we perish? We learn in times of high winds that Jesus is the only one to whom we can go. On normal days, we converse among ourselves freely and easily. But when our soul faces the terrible onslaught, when all human communication has been cut off, when father or mother or loved one cannot hear, for you cannot break through, there is one to whom you can go, one to whom you must go. You will waste no words with him. You will come urgently, insistingly, desperately, calling loudly in his ear, Master, I am perishing, don't you care? Desperate voices. High winds call forth desperate voices, and desperate voices call forth an unexpected word. Peace, be still. Only a command from Jesus, and the tempest is done. Mark says, a great storm of wind arose, and there was a great calm. Until now, how free have been our thoughts upon this text. How well do we understand the fury of the storm and the desperate plight of our humanity. How much easier it always is to focus it upon turmoil and crisis. How much more does the painting strike our eye when deep blotches of black and brown sweep across the canvas? How often have we fought the high winds? How well do we know the gnawing despondencies of doubt, the inner terror brought by the fear of failure, the personal inadequacies, the haunting sin-filled memory, the spiritual storm that rages in our hearts, pressed by Satan, left alone in the teeming mass of humanity, hating life and death. Peace, be still. Peace, be still. This is the last thing we are expecting. We know too well the high winds, the desperate voices, but too little the word of peace and the quiet of victory. We're hearing the blast of high winds these days. The age appears to be hopeless. The night, we are told, is dark. The Church of Jesus Christ is not the trained army it should be. Our contribution appears so potentially insignificant, and yet the Lord of the Lake of Galilee stands in our midst, and from him is coming this command, peace to the crashing waves, be still to the mighty winds. Peace, be still. It's the last thing we are expecting. It's precisely the last thing the disciples were expecting. Thus, Jesus speaks a second unexpected word. Why are you afraid? Have you no faith? No faith. Hear that. At least the disciples might have had some faith. At least they might have believed that as long as Jesus was in the boat, nothing could happen to them outside his will and control. At least they might have had a grain of mustard seed faith, but they had no faith, not even a little. And when you have no faith, you will always be afraid. Jesus expects us to have faith, no matter what. He told his disciples, let us go across to the other side. They had forgotten that word. And when you forget the word of Jesus, no faith is the result. Frequently we find consolation in the knowledge that God has appointed limits for all things, that no wind can blow everywhere at once or in one place forever, but it does not require faith to believe a storm will gradually end. It does not require faith to believe that life passes into death. No consolation is found in knowing that the highest wind must eventually taper off into a gentle breeze, so the word of Christ jars us. Why are you afraid? Have you no faith? Is not he who began a good work in you able to complete it? We are not serving a powerless Christ. We are not calling on the name of some miserably crucified man whose life forever ended nailed tight to a Roman cross. We are not gathered in these moments to sing songs to a God who cannot hear, or to pray prayers to a God who cannot answer, or to preach the redemption of a Christ who cannot redeem. We worship and serve the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He sets his glory and dominion before us and bids us to become large in faith. He says, look not at the storm, but at me. Look not at your little boat, but at me. And if Christ becoming man means anything, it means he is in the boat. The winds beat, the waves roll, the ship is going down. God is asleep. The disciples could see it. He who that day had taught the crowds, who had said such wonderful words about the sower and the seed, and who had spoken so forcefully of the kingdom of God, he was asleep. The ship is filling. The kingdom is lost. The king is lost. The king's subjects are sinking. Ah, if we could but realize for a moment, the ship cannot go down. If we are lost, God is lost. He has committed himself to our boat. If we drown, he drowns. Why are you afraid? Have you no faith? He does not courteously and condescendingly ask us if we have faith. He demands it of us and rebukes us when we lack it. High winds, desperate voices, and an unexpected word. They all tie in. High winds, the circumstances of life. Desperate voices, the weakness of our humanity in the midst of the circumstances. An unexpected word. A rebuke to the circumstances, peace be still, and a rebuke to the weakness of our humanity. Why are you afraid? Have you no faith? Thank God, He is with us. Thank God, He cares if we perish. Thank God, He saves us in our desperate plight. And thank God also, He speaks the word of rebuke in order that we might come to trust Him more. As the hymn writer has said, the wind and the waves shall obey my will, peace be still. Whether the wrath of the storm-tossed sea, or demons, or men, or whatever it be, no water can swallow the ship where lies the master of ocean and earth and skies. They all shall sweetly obey thy will, peace be still. Would you join me in a moment of prayer? You do speak your peace, Lord, to our heart. There are moments when the storms in our life are as turbulent as the storms in Galilee. There are moments when we are as frightened as are the disciples on the boat. There are moments when we think you've gone to sleep on us. And there are moments when we call upon you desperately to help us. Thank you, Lord, for helping us. Thank you that you will not go on sleeping when we are in life's storms. Thank you, Lord, for being not only the Lord of the Lake of Galilee, but being the Lord over our own circumstances. No matter what storm any of us faces in this room tonight, you are the Lord. And when we put our trust in you and believe your word that we are going to the other side, depend upon that with all of our heart, that we are going from man's side to your side, then when we believe that and trust in you, we'll see it come to pass. And when our faith fails, as did the disciples, that doesn't mean that you won't still act. For you always, Lord, are acting on our behalf. So we pray, Lord, a special little prayer for those here who are going through storms, that you would minister to them in their circumstances, give them faith to persevere, and Lord, in your own power, smite the storm which they face and bring peace both to the elements and to the heart. We ask it in your name. Peace.